The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. A warm hello to all our listeners, and welcome to today's program. This is Alita Khan from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from multiple sources, including the book Listening to the Children, Testimonies for the from the World's Blind and Partially Sighted Teenagers, and from Glamour Magazine, the February 2017 edition. Today's program is underwritten with support from the Raleigh-Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at www.kiwanisfoundation.org. And let's begin with our reading from the book titled Listening to the Children, Testimonies from the World's Blind and Partially Sighted Teenagers. And here is an essay submitted by Daylene Santa Cruz, age 16, from Cuba. Daylene writes, I am very proud of who I am, of my family, and of my country, which is not just interested in guaranteeing the rights of girls and boys, but respects and defends them. I have lived my entire life with sight problems, low vision, as I was born with a congenital condition known as Stargardt's disease. It was an ophthalmologist who diagnosed the condition. I have a visual acuity of 0.1 in both eyes and loss of central vision, so my peripheral sight is stronger. I live in the countryside with my parents, who love me just as I adore them. We are a simple and humble family. I studied primary education in a normal classroom in a mainstream school. I didn't go to a special school because it's quite far away from my home, and I would have needed a scholarship. My mother didn't want me to leave, so she decided I would go to the school where she is a teacher. Although she never taught me at school, she was my teacher at home. She always supported me in everything I needed, so I graduated from primary school with good marks. I moved on to a secondary school in the country called ESBEC, where I began my junior high studies. The curriculum for this level of education changed, and video-based classes were introduced. So I began to receive regular support from the instructors at the special school for the visually impaired. They instructed and trained the teachers and heads at the school on how to teach me in class and during other activities. JAWS was installed to help me to use the computer, and since then I have found it easy to handle. As for career advice, my mother was my inspiration, since she is a teacher. She has instilled in me a love of teaching since I was little. I was also very interested in arts, and above all dance, and I love dancing, especially to Cuban music. So when I started year 9, I decided to study to be an art instructor. That way I could enjoy the two things I love in life, dancing and teaching those who want to dance, including people who, like me, have a disability. When I found out the aptitude testing to enter the school was about to be held, I was a little worried and thought I wouldn't be offered a place. First of all, because I wasn't trained in dancing techniques, and secondly, due to my disability, because one of the consequences of my vision loss is that I have some features others don't have. So I started to get ready for the tests with support from a teacher who offered to help me. I also had support and encouragement from my parents and the teachers at the special school. I worked hard and showed a lot of interest, love, and perseverance. And then, finally, the big day arrived when I would take the tests to enable me to make my dream come true. I still thought I wasn't going to pass, but I was wrong because I was accepted with open arms. I was really delighted because they had recognized my skills and respected my rights as a person with disabilities. Right now, I am in second year at school. Everyone, students and teachers, help me and love me. I never feel left out. On the contrary, everyone tries to make me feel equal to everyone else. I am involved in all the center's activities, and I've taken part in few competitions where I've won prizes for poems I wrote on various subjects. Since I was young, I have been a member of the Cuban Association of the Blind and Partially Sighted, or the ANCI. I've taken part in a lot of the activities they organize, such as athletics competitions, and I've won or come second. For all of this, I have to thank my revolution, because if I hadn't been born and brought up in beautiful, independent Cuba, I would not have enjoyed so many opportunities. As a mixed-race person with a disability from a humble background, I have the same rights as anyone else to free education and health care, to enjoy everything we have here, and to be integrated into the labor market in society. And now we move on to Glamour Magazine, the February 2017 edition. And here is an article entitled, A Tale of Two Sisters. One is gay, one is straight. One's a comedian, the other a former pro cheerleader. And yeah, their styles are pretty different too. Here's Why None of That Matters, by Liana Carrera. My younger sister, Louisiana, and I grew up in super traditional Southern Baptist household. Our dad, a minister for the deaf, and our mom, a Baptist chaplain, and deaf herself, were church planters, meaning they opened a new ministry every few years all over the South. They loved to dress both me and Louisiana, or Didi, as I've always called her, in adorable ribbons and dresses and bows. To say we responded differently to all that would be an understatement. Even before I could speak or sign, my mom got the memo about how much I hated wearing the frilly things she put me in. I would scream and cry every time, and once I even managed to tear off my dress and streak into the front yard in rebellion. From day one, though, Didi crawled deliberately into the dresses I cast off. She liked to brush Barbie's hair and pick out outfits for Ken. I was more interested in having them make out with each other than ripping off their heads as punishment. True love waits. Didi liked painting her nails. I preferred a good paintball fight. As a preteen, my sister loved to pore over the beauty tips in fashion magazines. I tear out the pages and crumple them into basketballs. I'd like to say I tried to bridge our differences with empathy and understanding, but the older I got, the more I pulled away from my sister, thinking that what separated us on the surface probably meant we were different underneath, too. I often wondered whether we'd ever be friends. When I was in middle school, I went from shooting magazine paper balls into trash cans to playing in competitive travel leagues. Didi took up cheerleading. She was really into it, working endlessly to nail her stunts. One day, as she was practicing in front of the TV, swinging her side ponytail and blocking my view of family matters, I snapped. "There's no future in cheerleading," I said. "Pick a real sport." My sister froze. Her eyes locked. Her gloss lips quivered. "Cheerleading is a sport," she yelled, running out of the room. Didi didn't stop cheerleading, but she did stop cheering for me during my games or drive-away basketball. Did I miss her? You bet. But being 13, I never told her that. Nor did I tell her that there were times I envied her effortless femininity, though I'm sure she noticed the days I went to school in ill-fitting pink shirts and tight designer jeans in an effort to emulate her. Trying to dress like my sister was like trying to write in bubble letters. Seemed like a great idea, but looked a little dumb in practice. More often, I'd rummage through my father's closet for something to wear. He'd find me and joke, "Huh, aren't you supposed to be going through your mother's clothes?" Meanwhile, Didi would dig through my closet and huff, "It's not fair. Other peoples have sisters who share their clothes with. Why do you have to dress like a boy?" Once I snapped back, "Why do you dress like a hoe?" She didn't dress like a hoe, or maybe she kind of did. She was in middle school, after all. I was 16, and Didi was only 12 when I came out of the closet. I did it the way any dramatic teenager would, through song. Standing before my entire lacrosse team with my guitar, I sang and power-strummed my way through an angsty poem ending with the declarations, "I'm gay." My delivery might not have been Grammy-worthy, but everyone was cool with the fact that I'd spilled the beans, at least at school. When I broke the news to my parents, my mother retired to bed, where she would stay for a week. My dad took it in stride. I'd planned nervously to tell my sister in private, but Mom got to her before I could, lamenting to Didi, "You're not going to believe this, but your sister is a lesbian." Duh, my sister responded, her best wisecrack to date. Later, at our kitchen table, Dee Dee surprised me. I told Mom I didn't care at all. She said, her arm tight around me, I love you, as big as the sky. That was something our abuela used to say to us to help us understand that her love was unconditional and huge and everlasting. Could it be that my sister and I weren't so different after all? Unable to articulate how loved and grateful I felt, I ribbed. Too bad cheerleading still isn't a sport. It's a sport, she shrieked. Today, I know my mom was doing the best she could with the emotional tool she had. I'm a huge believer that we all need to show grace to the people we love. That in our truth will come their truth, even if it takes them a little longer to see it. But at the time, it was Dee Dee's easy acceptance that took some of the sting out of my mother's reaction. Once I was out, finding the right things to wear seemed even more important. I wanted people to look at me and see someone comfortable with who she was, and I was comfortable with my gay identity. I just had no idea how to express that through fashion. I vacillated between the masculine is me look, men's XL polos and baggy khaki pants, the skater girl's look, knit caps, flannels and joggers, and even occasionally the girly girl look, whatever fit me in Dee Dee's closet. When senior prom rolled around, I was excited about going with my girlfriend, but not about the matching sequin dresses we'd somehow decided to wear. While we both looked beautiful and the dance was fun, by the end of that night I knew with every fiber of my being that I never wanted to wear another dress again. It wasn't worth feeling like an alien to myself just to make other people happy. Flash forward 5 years to me, at 21, standing at my best friend Amber's wedding in a halter dress with a plunging neckline and bubble skirt. So much for that vow. I'd agreed to the get-up to make Amber's mom, a Southern Baptist like mine, comfortable. And it was tolerable. One gift that comes from a lifetime of growing up boyish in a conservative world is you learn not to be rigid and inflexible. But after the ceremony, sensing my discomfort, Amber pulled me aside and ordered, "Dude, put on a tie and pants at the reception." So I did, and gave away my bridesmaid's dress to her aunt, Susan, in the buffet line. And that really was the last time I wore a dress. Now, almost a decade later, I am a fully realized adult with fully realized tastes in people, wine, and clothes. I've discovered clothing lines that blend masculinity and femininity in a perfect way for tomboys and gender nonconforming people like Wild Fang, St. Harridan, Bindle and Keep, Sloan and Tate, and even gender-neutral boots made by Nick Casey. I live in Los Angeles, where I do stand-up comedy and am creating a show about my boyish experiences for television. I'm comfortable in my skin, and finally, I like it. So last year, when Dee Dee told me that she was getting married and added that familiar caveat from my past, "Mom wants you to wear a dress," I responded very differently than I had at 21. With all the love I could muster, I told my sister, "I'll be there. I'm so happy for you, but I just don't want to wear a dress." I wasn't sure how she'd react. At this point, she lived across the country from me, and while we talked on the phone occasionally, our lives had never been more different. Dee Dee had grown up to be a cheerleader ambassador for the NFL's Washington Redskins. My bad, there was a future in cheerleading. And loved clubbing, renting party buses with her friends, and watching YouTube makeup tutorials. She was marrying into a conservative Washington, D.C. family of police officers, FBI agents, and big game hunters. Of course, she envisioned a traditional, elegant wedding fit for a bridal magazine. But my sister didn't blink. "Okay, then you won't," she said. "I'll tell Mom it's my wedding, and you'll wear what you want." I chose a custom suit with a deep purple tie and pocket square. On the day of the wedding, when I hung the suit next to the bridesmaids' dresses in the bridal suite, the reaction was ecstatic. They included and embraced me without hesitation. But self-acceptance is an ongoing practice. Minutes before walking down the aisle, my nerves kicked in. I was suddenly aware of, A, how I risked making this whole thing look like a gay wedding whenever Dee Dee and I stood too close, and B, how far I was from my liberal Los Angeles bubble. Why hadn't I just worn a stupid dress to blend in? What saved me at the moment is what has always saved me, sisterhood. Dee Dee, my unlikely sidekick, gave me a hug, a laugh, and a push down the aisle. With that, I was able to confidently make my way forward. My sister even joked that I looked like I was working a red carpet. When it was time for my maid of honor speech, I took a deep breath and looked out at the crowd, shifting in their seats. "Hello, everyone," I said, signing up as I spoke so all the guests could understand. "I'm Liana, Louisiana's older, girlier sister." The hall exploded with laughter, and I braved on, skewering my father for having sobbed like a baby during his speech. "I'm not going to cry," I said. "Our dad took care of that." Then I paused to make eye contact with each member of my family. My mother, looking like a mermaid in her silver lamé gown, was smiling, seated next to my partner, whom she'd long ago embraced. My father, in a purple tie like mine, was relaxed and happy. And best of all, Dee Dee was laughing so hard she was doubled over and crying. If I hadn't realized it before, I realized it then. My sister is a spectacular friend. She gave me the space and love and support I needed to shine and to be me. And in turn, I gave her the support she needed to order Chipotle the night before she had to fit into a very expensive, tight wedding dress, and the strength to embrace the uniqueness of our family. Of course, I ended my speech by signing something important and true, that I loved her too, as big as the sky. Liana Carrera is a stand-up comic in Los Angeles. And here is another interesting article, also taken from Glamour magazine, the February 2017 edition. It is titled, "By Women for Women." What would happen if women created more of the fashion and beauty images we see? You know, like they do in this issue? The world would look spectacular, by Sean Dreisbach. The words female empowerment are everywhere these days. News reports, panels, even commercials trying to sell your body wash or paper towels. As a parody headline in The Opinion put it, "Women now empowered by everything a woman does," and generally, Glamour is all about that message. After all, one of the positive things that came out of the election this year is that it triggered a discussion about where we are in terms of gender and inequality, says Barbara Reisman, Ph.D., head of the Department of Sociology at the University of Illinois in Chicago. That social pressure, people coming together, making demands, is what helps push equality forward. But let's talk about the end goal of empowerment. Actually, you know, power. Spending power, earning power, political power. And in so many of these areas, the stats are dismaying. Consider, women account for just 15% of the top executives in the United States, and less than 5% of Fortune 500 CEOs. We're only 7% of pilots and flight engineers, and 20% of members of Congress. As our president-elect would say, sad. Our country needs all the talent we can get, says Reisman. We have lots of challenging issues facing us, and women make up half of that brain power. To not legitimize the power of women is to rob society of half its talent. At Glamour, we agree. So we decided to look at our own backyard. How often were we using female contributors to create the images you see on our pages? And how could we do better? We tallied up every assignment we made in 2016, and the numbers were underwhelming. Just 37% of the photographers, 32% of the hairstylists, and 49% of the makeup artists we'd commissioned were women. To be fair, we hit it out of the park in other areas. 94% of our writers were female, as were 80% of stylists. Our peers in the magazine industry had roughly the same numbers we did. And fashion and beauty, insiders say they're not surprised. On one level, women power the fashion and beauty industry, says photographer Amanda de Cadenay. We are the ones purchasing the product. Every ad and billboard is targeted to us. Yet the images that are being created are not being created by us. It's kind of offensive. There's no comprehensive data. But experts agree women are underrepresented in most prominent roles. While the vast majority of photographers, hairdressers, makeup artists, and designers in the industry are women, at the very top, it's mostly men, says historian Valerie Steele, director and chief curator of the museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. According to one study of top fashion labels, just 30% were designed or headed by women. And hair and makeup talent follow suit. Even in makeup, which you think would have a higher percentage of women, it's still very male on the creative side, says Charlotte Tilbury, one of the world's top makeup artists and the founder of Charlotte Tilbury Cosmetics. While we, as a magazine, can't change the gender gap in places like Congress or Wall Street overnight, we can change our own numbers. That's why, for this issue, every photographer, writer, hairstylist, and makeup artist the magazine hired was female. And we're making it our mission to collaborate with more women, not just this month, but every month, aiming to meaningfully increase the amount of original work we commission from talented female photographers, illustrators, makeup artists, hairstylists, and more by the end of 2017. The point isn't to elbow out men. We want to see all points of view. And hey, Patrick de Marchelier can come to our party anytime. But to ensure that glamour looks at the world the way women do, the way you do. The future is female. Let's rewind for a second. How is it that women haven't been getting the biggest, most buzzed about jobs? There is, after all, an incredibly deep pool of talented women in the fashion and beauty fields out there. Need proof? Scroll through Instagram. But women face two major roadblocks, experts say. One, models and celebrities often ask for men. In ad campaigns and even magazine covers, celebrities have a lot of sway. They get to decide who they want to work with for their photography, hair, makeup, and wardrobe styling, explains hairstylist Ursula Stevens, who works with performers including Rihanna, who, for the record, has been photographed for Glamour by both men and women. A lot of women choose men because they like the flamboyant flirting and over-the-top performance guys put out. They also don't want to feel intimidated by other women. Photographer Pamela Hansen agrees. A lot of celebrities prefer to be photographed by a man, she says. They like the sexual tension that occurs. The flattery is different, too. And good luck trying to find a female hairstylist or makeup artist on photo shoots. You can find plenty in this issue, including Hansen's own story. And another reason some celebs choose men? It's because, too, men rule the glass runway. That's a term some sociologists have used for the historical bias against women designers, and by extension female fashion photographers and hair and makeup talent. In the 20s and 30s, women really dominated high fashion in Paris, Lanvin, Chanel, Cécile. But after World War II, as a result of economic and cultural changes, it was back to the home for women, and suddenly fashion's big names were male. In the 50s, you had all these gender stereotypes. There was the idea that women are too close to it. They can only dress themselves. Men are the artists. That idea persists today. There is a subtle gendering in the fashion and beauty industry where if you're a woman interested in clothes or makeup, people assume you're superficial or somehow not as serious about your work. But if you're a man, you must be some sort of creative genius, says Alison Stokes, PhD, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, who studies the industry. My research shows that even when the words used to describe the collections of female designers are different, women's clothes are called things like wearable and great for real life, while terms like groundbreaking and innovative are applied to men's designs. That can apply to hair and makeup too. I do think there's this idea that hair done by women is considered more wearable and a man's work is sharp. And from the Spotlight section of Glamour Magazine, February 2017 edition, we have a little snippet. It's called Spotlight by Marilyn Minter. We need to hear other voices. It used to be that you were either a good girl or a bad girl in our culture, and it's such bull. This new, in conclusion, any feminism is no longer about white women of privilege, and we need to accept women in powerful positions. If women were running things, we'd see a broader range of ages and body types, and powerful women who are not afraid to create their vision and stop apologizing for it. Marilyn Minter is a photographer and artist whose work has appeared everywhere from the Museum of Modern Art in New York to Guggenheim Bilbao in Spain. Follow her on at Marilyn Minter. And now from the internet's facts.randomhistory.com, here are a few more interesting facts about human emotions and instincts. Types of triggers that humans are evolutionarily prepared to fear, such as cage snakes, evoke a visceral response even though humans know they are relatively harmless on a cognitive level. However, humans are less likely to react with fear to dangerous risks that evolution has not prepared them for, such as hamburgers, smoking, and unsafe sex, even though most people recognize the danger on a cognitive level. A 1980 study by Robic Plutkik proposed 8 primary innate emotions: joy, acceptance, fear, surprise, sadness, disgust, anger, and anticipation. He suggests that complex emotions such as guilt and love are derived from combinations of primary emotions. Studies show that if people adjust their facial expressions to reflect an emotion, they actually begin to feel that emotion. And research has shown that the expression and experience of negative emotions, like depression and anxiety, show higher activation in the right frontal cortex and in the deeper brain structures, such as the amygdala, while positive emotions are accompanied by more left frontal cortex activity. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. We hope that you've enjoyed our revamped format and broader content presentations intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, and we look forward to hearing your remarks. Be sure to listen next time, and remember that this broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. I am Alida Khan, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, wishing you a lovely, safe, and productive week. Until next time, I leave you with this thought for the day. Do not pray for an easy life. Pray for the strength to endure a difficult one. And that was said by Bruce Lee. For comments, questions, or suggestions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.